For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, we're going to look at Jesus and his greatness, but I'm going to do it in a very indirect manner. It will, when by the time I get to that point, you will see it in a new light that I doubt you have ever seen before. I'm not going to get there immediately. I gave this talk once in a church and I said, I'm not going to get to Jesus immediately. I'm not going to get to the Bible immediately. And somebody got up and walked out. I am going to get there, but I'm going to do it through a context that will make some facts about Jesus more clear, more interesting, more amazing than you have probably thought of them before. Too good to be false. What this is, besides the greatness of Jesus, is it is an apologetics talk, and it's about the origin of the Jesus story. And was it Sean that said that when you start to have a conversation with someone about Jesus, you should start with something that people agree with? Well, when it comes to the origin of the Jesus story, is it true? Is it false? Is it legend? When you're dealing with people who disagree with you, you want to start with something you agree with. And everyone agrees, this one's pretty easy. There's a story. There is a story, the accounts of Jesus' life, or maybe four stories, you know, because we're talking about the four Gospels. Now, they interconnect, obviously, but there's a story, the accounts of Jesus' life. Everybody agrees that such a story exists. And here's the next line. This is pretty easy, too. The story came from somewhere. Do you think we can get most atheists to agree with that? Story came from, every story comes from somewhere. I have a story about the traffic on the way here. I was driving from Lebanon, about an hour and a half southwest of here. I got a story about how Eric Chabot and I have been friends for a while, and that's how he was influential here and arranged for an invitation for me to come and share with you guys. There's a story there. Now, if I had said that the reason I'm here is because Eric Chabot and I have been friends for a long time, and he absolutely despises me, and that's why I'm here, you would say, wait a minute, something doesn't fit, because here you are standing here. And the end of the story doesn't fit with the where it came from. Every story, in other words, has a backstory, a story behind the story. If you hear a Grimm Brothers fairy tale, you know it was written by the Brothers Grimm back in Germany, back in whenever it was, you know, the late Middle Ages, I think. I haven't studied that. But every story has a backstory, where it came from. Now, there has to be a story behind the story. What I want to say is the backstory to the accounts of Jesus comes in two different forms, and one of them is skeptical form, one of them is the Christian belief form. And, well, let me just overview the argument. The gospel accounts came from somewhere. That's the easy part. The backstory must be consistent with the story. That is, the cause of the story, where they came from, the accounts that we have, should be consistent with the effect, which is the resulting story that's produced by the things that led up to the production of the story. Does that make sense? If the backstory doesn't fit the story, then you got to wonder if somebody's telling you the truth about the backstory. Make sense? Okay. I'm sure if J. Warner Wallace were here, he would talk about this in terms of the story that witnesses produce, and it doesn't fit the result. The story should be, and the backstory should be, consistent with one another. Now, skeptics say that the story of Jesus is a legend that arose through a flawed and for some seriously deluded community of faith. We're going to look at that one sentence in some considerable detail. That's what skeptics say. We're going to come back to that in some detail, but this is just the overview. But the accounts that we have present a consistent account of moral genius unlike any in all other human history and human literature. Moral genius of that sort is completely inconsistent with the skeptic's theory And therefore, well, it does fit with the other proposed backstory, which is that the gospel accounts came from people who actually observed or spoke with, in the case of Luke, for example, people who actually observed a man of moral genius unlike any other. Two backstories, either the legend or the truth. Which one fits? I'm going to pray. Father, I thank you for the chance to share on these ideas, to look at what skeptics say, to look at what the Bible says, to look at who Jesus is. And I pray that as a result of this, not only would we understand another way to be confident of the truth of the Gospels, but that we would understand and know and actually be gripped with reason to worship Jesus, because he is so great. I pray this in his holy name. Amen. This is, by the way, my favorite talk, my favorite topic, because it combines my two favorite ones, apologetics and Jesus Christ. What a combination. This talk is actually a new defense of the Gospels. It's one that you have probably never heard. It's an old one in the sense that if you go back over 100 years, you'll find people like, well, C.H. Robinson. This is in your notes. I'll just read it. He says, "We may accept the assertion that the Gospels are unhistorical or that they were not written by their supposed authors, but as we do so, we are confronted with the insoluble problem of one or more unknown writers creating and setting forth the only conception of a perfect character which the world has ever known." Or as Philip Schaff, another historian, he wrote a great history of the church just over 100 years ago, said, "If the early Christians produced Christ, who produced the early Christians? The poets, in this case, must have been superior to the hero." I'll show you why as we go along. Here's the skeptic's version. I want you to see what the skeptics say. Again, this is an overview. I'm going to cover each of these in a little more detail. The skeptics say that the Jesus legend came from a, quote, community of faith. And so there was this group of people who had been following Jesus, and something happened. They remained, and he died. They remained a community of faith. And they produced the Jesus legend. Well, they did it falsely. They were propagating untruths because Jesus didn't rise from the dead. They said he did, but it wasn't true. And they did it through the telephone game, which got mentioned here, where you speak into one person's ear and you go around the circle, and it produces distortions. Things change. And they did it to support their psychopathology, which we will get into a little bit more too. Not every skeptic supports every part of this version of the backstory, but it's a fairly accurate general picture of what skeptics say explains the origin of the four Gospels. Now, in more detail, Reza Aslan, who wrote Zealot, best-selling author, these guys make so much money. You go into the bookstores and there's so much atheist material, and the good stuff is so hard to find. He said that the Gospels are not, nor were they ever intended to be, historical documentation of Jesus' life. They're not eyewitness accounts of Jesus' word and deeds recorded by people who knew him. They are testimonies of faith composed by communities of faith and written many years after the events they describe. Communities means groups of people. Faith in that language means delusion, because we Christians, we're faith heads. We don't believe evidence. Faith is believing what you know isn't true, according to the Skeptics Dictionary, or it's pretending to know things you can't know, according to Professor Peter Boghossian. So we're already off to a bad start with this faith word, but the communities thing, that's going to fall apart, actually, in a few minutes. But they were presenting falsehoods. Marcus Borg, who was famous in the Jesus Seminar, said that the Gospels are not first and foremost reports of the ministry. Chris Komarnitsky, whose basic claim to fame is that he's an atheist writer, said that from our perspective, 2,000 years later, the emergence of such traditions might seem like an implausibly large lie. But from the perspective of the earliest Christians, the inaccuracy was probably inconsequential. Yeah, okay, we said he rose from the dead, but, you know, sure, it's wrong, but it's not a big error. Like, because, you know, we've got faith or something. A similar, well-intended, and from their point of view, minor distortion of the truth happened in the early Mormon movement. Well, no, actually, the Mormons didn't consider it a distortion of the truth. They considered it true. And if it was a distortion of the truth, which I say it is, it was a big one. The angel Moroni did not come and deliver golden plates and that Joseph Smith translated with the Urim and Thummim. It just didn't happen. It's a lie. And they founded a whole religion on it. And this is not an implausibly large lie. It's just a lie. Well, it is implausibly large, too. I'll go with that. Bart Ehrman. Boy, is he the one who's making money. He's the one who has the best statement of the telephone game that I know of. So we've gotten from the community of faith propagating untruth through the telephone game. Watch what happens to the community. You've got this in your notes. I'll read it. This is how Christianity spread year after year, decade after decade. And what do you suppose happened to the stories over the years as they were told and retold, not as disinterested news stories, but as propaganda meant to convert? Told by people who had themselves heard them fifth or sixth or 19th hand. And then he goes on to talk and describe the telephone game. And it ends up with a different story at the end. Now he says, imagine playing telephone not among a group of kids of the same socioeconomic class, from the same neighborhood, the same school, speaking the same language. But imagine playing it over 40 years or more, in different countries, different contexts, different languages. What happens to the stories? They change. Well, he said they change. What happens to stories, really, when they go through that kind of a process? Is change a strong enough word? They're bound to become completely distorted. Unrecognizable. This is a completely distorting process. And the communities thing, communities of faith, well, yeah, stretched out over the whole Mediterranean region in different languages, if you call that a community of faith, this starts to look increasingly implausible to me, but we haven't gone anywhere yet. We do have to say, what happens to the stories? Yes, indeed. They change. It gets worse because what happened during this period was the reason the stories arose is because this community of faith had lost their leader. They had lost Jesus. He had died. And as Marcus Borg says again, religions in general, including Christianity, it seemed to me, were manifestly cultural products. I could see how their readily identifiable sociological and psychological and social functions served human needs and cultural ends, which has nothing to do with whether it's true, but whether it meets your needs. I got needs. Can you meet my need? Oh, yeah, Jesus rose from the dead. Interesting how that particular story came about, though. What we got here is a long line in front of comforting lies and a very short line leading up to unpleasant truths. When I was in college, I came across a book, which is not in the right place in the slides here, but that's okay. I'm going to go back. Came across a book called When Prophecy Fails by Leon Festinger. Festinger was able to get a member of his team as a psychologist inserted into a little social group. And this is a very strange social group. It pains me to say that this happened in Michigan. I grew up there. I went to Michigan State, just so you're, in case you're worried. I didn't go to the one that we all, you know. Anyway, yeah, I have to say that in Columbus particularly. This was a very strange social group. It was led by a Mrs. Keach, the name they used in the book, who had heard a message from aliens in the planet Clarion, who told her that they were going to destroy the earth for its wickedness, and that she needed to gather as many people as she could to come to her house and wait at midnight of New Year's Eve. This was in the mid-1950s, 1955, I think. And they were to sell everything and gather and wait with Mrs. Keach to be spirited away just before the destruction of the earth. And she did gather a community and included professional people, included respectable people. She convinced people that they had to sell everything. And this really happened. This is actual social movement, small one. And they came, and they were united, and they were a community for real. And they waited, and guess what happened at midnight? Nothing. What do you do? Yeah, right. You know, some people blew, you know, little, you know, to, you know, razor things and maybe some fireworks. Nothing happened. What do you do when you have invested so much of yourself with a group in something that proves to be totally undeniably false? This is what happened to me. This is what they did. Mrs. Keach got another message from the planet Clarion, and it said, because of your sincerity, we have delayed the destruction. You have done well. She was able, or the aliens, were able to make it true again, even though it was undeniably false. This is called cognitive dissonance reduction that's going on here. You've heard the word cognitive dissonance. It's been used here once. The technical meaning of cognitive dissonance is actually quite interesting. It requires, first of all, a significant active investment of your identity and your resources in a belief. You are really into this. And then it takes, the belief has to come out to be undeniably false. So you are really into it, and suddenly you are really wrong. And there is a huge, well, dissonance is a good word for it, between identity and reality. And do you change your identity to match the new reality? That's pretty hard when you are in a social group that joins you in that identity. It's really hard for the whole group to change. And so what you do is you find a way. There's the book. I love that cover. That was the cover when I did the book in college back 40 or 60 or 100 years ago. It's just so blobby. It's so 60s. Anyway, it's actually 1975. Anyway, you find a way to make it true again. And that's what cognitive dissonance reduction theory is about. Significant active investment of resources in a belief. It turns out to be undeniably false. You got social support that makes it hard to change your identity. And that's what the disciples of Jesus had happen to them. Their Messiah died. They were a community. They were invested in this belief. Chris Komarnitsky says the belief that Jesus died for our sins, was raised from the dead, may have been a way for Jesus' followers to reconcile in their minds his death with their previous hope that he was a Messiah. Their rationalization didn't need to be perfect. Yeah, it wasn't perfect. They made up a resurrection. That's kind of far off. Not perfect. Okay, but it did need to adequately answer what would seem to be the two most natural and pressing questions. Why did the Messiah have to die, and how can a dead person be the Messiah? Well, a resurrection works for that. Let's make it up. That's what skeptics often, not every skeptic, but that's a typical skeptical belief regarding the origin of the Jesus story. You know what this is, though? This is crazy. This is nuts. This is like, we don't have the truth in mind. We're just taking care of ourselves. This is not good. So again, where do these stories come from? The skeptical theory is the inventors of the story of Jesus were at least, you know, the skeptics would say some of these, possibly all of these, they were a non-community of faith, a cognitive flaw, distorting everything through a game of telephone with the purpose of propagating untruths and dragging others in with them, dressed up in pretend honest clothing, and propping themselves up psychologically when they're unable to face reality. That's where the stories came from. Does that theory hold up? I'm not so sure. And this is the part where it starts to get really fun. But it only starts here, because I'm not going to talk about Jesus yet. I'm going to make you wait a little longer. It gets really good then. Let's put Jesus in context. It's a story, right? It came from somewhere. Let's talk about stories. Let's talk about stories from history, stories from imagination, stories from mythology, stories from comic books and film. Wherever you want to think about it, including real history, who are some of the most powerful, I mean, people who could get what they wanted, do what they wanted, people in all of history and all of human imagination?
Caesar.
Caesar. Okay, powerful. Yeah. Who else?
Alexander the Great.
He was so upset when he'd conquered the world, there's nothing left to conquer, as far as he could see. Yeah. Who else?
Stalin.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Hitler. Somebody yesterday said Thanos. I mean, we can go into imagination here, right?
Odin.
Sure. Powerful characters. Okay. I wish I could write on a board. There's not a good way to erase it. But just imagine that we had put these people on a list. You know, Caesar, Odin, Thanos, Alexander the Great, all these folks, okay, on this side of the board. On the other side of the board, in your mind's eye, you're going to write a different list. And this is a list of people who are in history, and not including the Bible, in all of human history and all of human imagination, again, same scope, people who are incredibly giving, other-oriented, self-sacrificial, really other-centered people. It's a different question. So who can you think of that fits that description that we could write up here? If it would be Santa Claus, okay.
Gandhi.
Mother Teresa. Okay, yeah, Socrates, Nelson Mandela, yeah. Someone in, I asked this once, they said, Mom, I thought that was the best answer ever. Now, what do you notice about these two lists? I'm going to back that up. You've got a list of powerful people. You've got a list of other-centered people. Is there any overlap? There is in one character that I know of, and that's Superman, but he's a special case. I'll come back to him. There is no overlap between the people who are incredibly powerful and the people who are incredibly giving in all of human history and imagination. Why? Abraham Lincoln said, very wisely, I think, he said, nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. If a guy can do something or a woman can do something and get something and obtain something and have power over something, what's the impulse? It's to get something, have power over something. It's a self-centered impulse. And for that reason, even, you know, much more famously, Lord Acton said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, and that's why that list of powerful is so different from this list of other-centered and giving and self-sacrificial. But what if we include the Bible? Next to the part that we can agree on over the story came from somewhere. This is probably an easier question. Is there anybody in the Bible who is really powerful and really self-sacrificial? Moses, Jesus.
Abraham.
Yeah. But the one who stands out is Jesus Christ. Yeah. Sorry. Above all, I mean, let's just look at it. The power. Superman flew through the air. In John 1, 1 through 5, we've got the account. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And through Him," I'm trying to get there really quick, "through Him all things were created, and apart from Him not one thing was created that has been created. In Him was life." Superman flew through the air. Jesus created the air. That's a difference of power. And by the way, we don't have to, if we're talking with skeptics about this, we don't have to ask them to believe that this is true. We just have to get them to recognize that this is part of the account. Any more than Superman. We don't have to, we can talk about Superman without believing the story is true, right? We can talk about Jesus as the one who is represented as being incredibly powerful in literature. He's the ruler over nature. I went sailing last Saturday in Cowan Lake, which is not far from where I live in Lebanon. And I've sailed a lot. And I love this story. I won't go there now, but it's the one where Jesus is asleep in the back of the boat and the disciples freak out because there's a storm on. He stands up, he says, "Peace be still," and the wind stops. Which, you know, if you're really, really lucky with your timing and you stand up and say, "Stop, wind," and the wind stops, you could be, you know, one in a billion chance you got it right, okay? But the waves stop too. And as a sailor, I know that the waves don't stop when the wind stops. He stopped them both. That impresses me. He's the ruler over nature. Feeding the 5,000. Suppose you had mentioned, you know, on our list of powerful people, we could have included people with incredible economic power, like Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or somebody like that. And, you know, if they wanted to, you know, write a check and provide pizza for everyone at an Ohio State football game, where what, you get 2,000-4,000 people coming? I'm trying to think. they could probably pull it off. But Jesus didn't need to write a check. He had economic power. He could go with, you know, 5 loaves, 2 fishes, and create food. He had the ability. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. But that's in a different account. But he had that kind of power. And in Mark 5, 35 to 43, we've got him raising the dead son of the widow. In John 11, we've got the story of him raising Lazarus from the dead. He raised the dead. There isn't anybody with that kind of power. Really, even very often in imagination. Jesus is portrayed as a person of immense power, okay? He is also portrayed as a person who is perfectly other-centered. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life, a ransom for many. He's the Good Shepherd. He's the one who cares about these stinky things. And He lays down His life for the sheep, He says in that passage, which He went ahead and did. But first, you know, there was this other teaching, Luke 10, 25 through 37. That's the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, if I made up the story of the Good Samaritan and taught it to you and say, this is the way you should live, you would probably be, or you would be well within your rights to say, yeah, but are you living it? And I would duck, because that's story scares me. It's the story of someone who let his life be interrupted for another person's needs. And I'm not very good at that. Jesus told the story, and nobody said, yeah, but are you like that? He was a credible ethicist. He said in Matthew 5, love your enemies. Who can actually teach that and not have someone come back and say, well, yeah, but do you do it? Yeah, there are a few, but it's rare, perhaps. And then the most giving thing of all, and I'm going to read about it in Philippians. You know, everybody who's ever died, everybody who's ever lived has died. Who is it who has ever chosen to die? You can say, I chose to die on a particular day, but you can't say I chose to die because nobody has a choice in it. Everyone who's born has to die. Jesus didn't have to be born. He chose to die. In Philippians, it says, have the same attitude in you as was in Christ Jesus, who existing in the form of God did not consider equality with God as something to be exploited. Instead, he emptied himself by assuming the form of a servant, taking on the likeness of humanity. And when he had come as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even to death on a cross. That's giving. He did it for us. He didn't do it for himself. He didn't have to die. He could have escaped it, even up to the last second, by calling in legions of angels. He chose to do it for us, completely sacrificing his life for us. That's giving. Now, as I was thinking about this, the part that really got to me is this. Suppose you won the Powerball, $100 million, say, for a nice round number. And suppose you were the most giving person in all of Ohio and Michigan. And suppose you were incredibly other-centered and you were going to give all of it away. Would you buy your kids some new shoes? Would you fix the roof or the brakes? Would you use some of it? A little bit for yourself? When did Jesus ever employ his extraordinary powers for his own benefit? I asked Mike Lacona once. Some of you know who he is. He's another apologist. And he said, well, he healed Peter's mother-in-law, and she got up and served him. And I said, well, that proves two things. One is, Mike, you know your scriptures really well because you came up with that right away. And the second thing is you're a smart aleck. So, no, that's not what Jesus, he wasn't doing that for so someone could serve him. To have the power that Jesus had and not to use it for his own benefit. When he was starving in the desert after his 40 days of fasting and the devil said, you could turn this rock into bread. He said, no. He refused to use his power for himself. Who does that? Who is that giving? Who is that much a man for others? That's Bonhoeffer's term. Is anybody in this room that giving? If you are, I mean, I look at that, and there's a doctrine of Jesus' deity that says it's okay to worship him. But I think of trying to be that good, and that's when I fall to my knees, and I say, you are too great for me even to I can hardly stand it, how good he is. But I want to emulate it anyway. So let's just consider for a while the stunning magnificence of the one character depicted in all of human literature who was that powerful and that good. Shakespeare didn't come up with that person. Shakespeare was good. He wasn't good enough to come up with that character. Sophocles, Goethe, Dickens. It's really hard to write a story about a really good person and make it compelling. I could do it. You know, I'll do it real quick. Alvin was really, 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 really powerful, and he always used his power for others. The end. You know, the problem with almost all the stories about really good people is that they're really boring. You need somebody who's just kind of a mess in there to be the main character. Has the story of Jesus proven to be compelling? Well, yeah, for thousands of years in every part of the world. This is an amazing story, as stories go. Where did it come from? The skeptics think it came from this distorting process. This incredibly distorting process. Does it fit? Was the story produced by a group of people who were supremely messed up, using a process that's supremely distorting Or is it more likely that the story is actually the result of somebody having observed Jesus Christ and writing down the story, the account of an actual life that was actually lived? The backstory behind the skeptic's version doesn't fit the account. The backstory behind the other version, that Jesus actually did live this way, does fit the story that was produced. Does that make sense? The cause is Jesus. The result is the stories of Jesus. That fits. The cause is this distorting process, and it comes out with a story of Jesus. That doesn't fit. This, I think, is an evidence for the historicity of the Gospels, which is that the legends, the legend theory doesn't fit the result that you see in the accounts in the Bible. Make sense? You with me? So in other words, you can take your pick. Do you want the backstory that doesn't fit the story? You want the backstory that does fit the story? So some comments on this would be, first of all, the argument doesn't require anything of anybody. This is one of the unique things about this argument. For everything else that we're discussing here, you have to know, for example, that the gravitational constant is tuned to such and such a degree of perfection, or that there are how many manuscripts? 23,000. You have to know that, or you have to know how soon the... For this argument, I only know of one other. James Rochford taught on it the other day. It's Lydia McGrew's Hidden in Plain View. This book and this argument on Jesus are the only ones that I know of that you can just get the data from the New Testament. And a little bit of knowledge of other literature, too, and history. I mean, you need to know something about people to know that that the story of Jesus is as unique as it is. Superman said he was a special case. He was crafted as a Jesus figure. By his Jewish creators. And if you look at the original Superman movies, I think it was the second one that was marketed with a poster showing him suspended in space in this position. And the trailers had Jor-El saying, "For this reason, I have sent them you, my only son." Is that kind of maybe a reference to this is a little bit about copying Jesus? The Superman story is a copy, but even Superman used his heat vision to warm his coffee. He used his extraordinary powers for his own benefit. Jesus didn't. It's really unique. So, you don't need to know much except for what the Gospels say. You need a little general knowledge of history and literature. If you're addressing a particular skeptic's version of the legend theory, you might need to know a little bit about what they're talking about so you can focus your answer to their question. But this doesn't take much knowledge. It's one of the things I love about it. Once you know the argument, it's pretty easy to remember it without having a lot of details in your head. I have heard a couple of objections to this, but they are weak. I would, and I've had this online on my blog, where there are active atheist community responding. There may be better objections, but I haven't heard them yet. One of them is that Jesus wasn't so great after all. Jesus didn't snap his fingers and end slavery, which if he had, well, he's going to do that. But he's going to end a lot of other things with it at the same time and start some new things too. Or Jesus didn't endorse gay marriage, so he wasn't such a good person after all. Now, you don't have to get in the argument over whether Jesus should have endorsed gay marriage. You can just set that one aside, because that one's a tough one and a complicated one. It does have an answer, but it takes a long time and it's hard to convince. Do this instead. This is what I call the diamond on the beach approach. Say, okay, you don't like everything about Jesus, but here's this one thing. He was incredibly powerful, incredibly other-oriented. That's incredibly unique. Suppose you're walking on the beach and you see a large diamond, cut and polished, sparkling there. And you go, "Wow, that's amazing." And your companion walking with you says, "There's a lot of sand around here and dead fish." You say, "Well, we need to understand where that diamond came from." "Well, there's a lot of seaweed around here." That's what they're doing. You know, they're ignoring the sparkling diamond of this at least one really solidly identifiable, unique, ethical point of perfection. They're ignoring it because they don't like something else that's in the on the beach. Say, look, forget about the fish and the seaweed, and let's just figure out, what about this diamond? Do you have an explanation for it? It doesn't fit your story. So don't get into the, you know, Jesus wasn't so great after all those other arguments. Talk about the diamond. Just give you a clue of how bad the objections have been. This is the second best objection I've seen, which is that it's not persuading me. Well, duh, a lot of arguments are like that. This is not very strong counter-arguments. If you have a stronger one, I would love to hear it, because I want to know how to answer it. That's what I've heard so far, believe it or not. So that's the argument. I'm going to spend a moment talking with you about how to do it yourself in practice. And I've heard some really encouraging words from people who's taken this argument and used it with high schoolers, with friends, with family, and so on. What you don't want to do is go into cognitive dissonance theory, unless you really want to tell the story of Mrs. Keach and the aliens from the planet Clarion and stuff. But really what you do is you start where I didn't start. You start in the middle of my talk, which you say, tell me about someone really powerful. Tell me about everyone you can think of really powerful in history and literature except the Bible. Tell me about everyone who's really giving. What do you notice about those lists? They don't overlap. They only overlap in one place. And why is that one story, the account of Jesus, so different from everything else in all of human literature and history? How do you explain the uniqueness of the story of Jesus? Well, they say, well, I don't know about the story of Jesus. You say, well, read it. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to believe the story to check out whether it's a unique story. Just go read the Gospels. And by the way, you're sneaking them an exposure to Jesus in there. That's always good for people. Because he's a compelling character. He's a wonderful character. No wonder people have loved him. So that's a good thing. Just direct them to the story and then say, okay, you didn't know it before. Don't you think now that there's something unique about this character? What explains the story of this unique character? There is no other good explanation for it except that it's true. Because fake processes don't produce such perfect, ethically perfect characters. A few final implications. I already mentioned this. If they're not open to thinking about God or even miracles, you can point them to Jesus anyway. I started off by saying, how could one man carry the weight that Jesus carries? This weird tale of someone who lived 2,000 years ago and everything in all of human history, past, future, and eternity, depends on one man. How could one person carry that much weight? Jesus is different. He's got what it takes. He can carry the weight. Only Jesus could carry the weight of human history on his shoulders, and he does it. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier. If you want to read the longer version of it, it's in my book, Christian Life for Sale Downstairs. And that's the presentation.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.